This is Mac Format This Week. 30 minutes of news, reviews, Q&A, and features from the world of the Macintosh, iPod, and iPhone. Coming up on this edition, Adobe speaks out.
If moving from carbon to cocoa gets you all these theoretical benefits, then why has Apple not chosen to make that move with some of their flagship software?
Is the wait in the next version of Photoshop worth it? Photoshop manager John Knack joins us and questions Apple's future development roadmap. And the craze in shareware bundles.
The developers get a whole host of benefits. You're getting exposure, you're building your user base, and you're just getting your name out there. So I think it's good for shareware developers.
We talked to one company that bundles shareware for a package price. How does it work, and is it right for you? All this and more on this edition of Mac Format This Week. With the resources of Mac Format Magazine, this is Mac Format This Week. Hello again, everyone. I'm Brad Gibson. Adobe has announced it will be delaying for the foreseeable future the next release of Photoshop Creative Suite 4 for Mac. The reason for the delay? Apple's decision, announced last July, to switch from one software code standard to another. Specifically, Apple decided to switch from the application programming environment called Carbon to another called Cocoa. Its reasons are debatable, but in a nutshell, Apple feels Cocoa ensures better performance with today's faster Macs that use what is called 64-bit processing. What does 64-bit computing mean? Well, basically, it lets an application more efficiently address large amounts of memory, say 4 gigabytes or more. And with today's Macs allowing for more memory and software gobbling up that memory, Apple feels 64-bit processing and the benefits of Cocoa are essential. But the switch for programmers like Adobe is easier said than done. It'll require massive amounts of man-hours to rewrite their code, so long that Adobe can't say exactly when the next version of Photoshop CS4 will be available. But more importantly, Adobe is publicly questioning whether the Apple switch to Cocoa will actually mean a substantial performance advantage that is worth the wait. It's an interesting and unusually open public debate. Adobe, an influential software company that Apple needs, speaking up while smaller developers can't afford to for fear of repercussions from Apple. I recently spoke with John Knack, senior product manager for Photoshop, and began by asking him to explain why Adobe is having to delay the 64-bit version of Photoshop CS4.
Our plan was to ship 64-bit versions of Photoshop CS4 for both Mac and Windows. We found out, though, last summer that Apple had changed their plans. Prior to WWDC 07, their plan of record was that they were going to offer a 64-bit version of both Carbon and Cocoa, so the two ways to develop Mac applications. Photoshop and the rest of the Creative Suite, along with Final Cut, iTunes, Finder, Microsoft Office, and a bunch of apps, are written using Carbon. And so Apple had previously planned to make it possible to run a 64-bit Carbon-based app. What they decided at WWDC 07 was to cancel that plan and to say that if you want to be 64-bit with a GUI, you need to do the GUI through Cocoa. So in a nutshell, it changed the amount of work that's required of us. It's a non-trivial effort. Nobody's ever ported an app the size of Photoshop from Carbon to Cocoa. And so it's simply going to take more time than we had expected.
Okay, now, John, you all found out about this last June at WWDC. Why did it take 10 months to announce that you'd be delaying the 64-bit version?
Normally, we don't say anything about a new version until we announce it. And so actually saying anything now is a bit out of the ordinary. The reason we chose to do it now, is that Lightroom 2 is now shipping as a beta, and it's runs in 64-bit mode on both Mac and Windows. It can do that because it was a Cocoa app from the beginning. So we figured that, well, once we announce this news, people are naturally going to ask, what does that mean for Photoshop and After Effects and a bunch of other products? So on the Photoshop team, we decided that we should kind of break with tradition a little bit and try to give guidance sooner rather than later.
What does 64-bit computing mean for the user? I mean, what kind of performance benefits does it bring?
Well, I'm trying to strike the right balance between not overselling it, because it certainly isn't some sort of magic bullet, and also not underselling it, because there are circumstances where it really matters. So really, in a nutshell, 64-bit lets you address more than 4 gigs of RAM with any application. So right now on the Mac, due to Photoshop being a 32-bit process, and also the way that interacts with the OS, you get to address a bit more than 3 gigabytes of RAM using CS3. If you were running a 64-bit app, you could essentially address as much as you would like. So you could jam, you know, 32 gigs of RAM in your machine and go from there. Now, whether you want to address that much RAM with any given application really depends on what kind of work you're doing and whether it's important to be able to, you know, fit an enormous image, let's say, into memory all at once. So for most people, you know, if you're just doing general digital photography stuff or if you're doing web design, really 64-bit isn't going to make a difference. There'll be, you know, some marginal performance improvement probably. Now, I have to qualify that a little because we're still pretty early on and I don't want to give you really bulletproof numbers, but, you know, you might see on the order of a 10% speed bump, which of course is always welcome. Nobody, you know, wouldn't want a speed bump. But really, it's not a very substantial thing. I wouldn't, you know, with good conscience, sell somebody a 64-bit version saying, oh, yeah, you know, you're throwing around animated GIFs and it's going to be so much faster now. It's really substantial only when you're working with really large files that would otherwise saturate 3 gigs of RAM or less.
Does Apple's decision to abandon 64-bit Carbon development, do you see it as a wise decision? Can you understand why they've decided to do it?
You know, I mean, generally speaking, we leave it to Apple to make the calls about what's best for the platform. I mean, I can empathize with any product team that has to make tough calls about, you know, having a lot more things they would like to do than they have time and bodies to do it. So, you know, it's really their call about how they spend the resources. The thing I've tried to be clear about is that I hope folks, you know, don't get into a kind of a blame game either way. I mean, it's either blaming Apple or blaming Adobe. It's one of those things where they decided for their own reasons to change the roadmap. That's fine. We'll deal with it. We've dealt with it before. But it doesn't mean we can do it overnight.
But Apple's been promoting Cocoa for ages, no?
So I have to push back on that a little bit because there seems to be this feeling in the Mac community, and folks can never really actually give me a reason technically why this would be, but this feeling that, well, if you write a Carbon application, it's somehow a second-class citizen, and you know, if only you were to rewrite it in Cocoa, things would be faster and more Mac-like and more stable and whatnot. And that's actually not the case. Now, Cocoa, you know, is a great way to develop apps. You know, if you write an app from scratch, it's a perfectly good way to go. And in fact, the Lightroom team, you know, when they chose to write a new application, chose Cocoa as the way to do that. It doesn't mean, however, that, you know, simply porting over an app like, let's say, Final Cut, which is based on Carbon, you know, would magically transform it into a more Mac-like program. And I guess to me, you know, that's one of the questions I have to ask is, well, if moving from Carbon to Cocoa gets you all these theoretical benefits, then why has Apple not chosen to make that move with some of their flagship software?
But Apple's been migrating to 64-bit processors since 2006. I mean, wasn't it clear that this was going to be the future?
Oh, it's entirely clear that 64-bit is the future. In fact, I think it goes back further. Actually, the G5 is a 64-bit processor. So I think it's like probably August of 2003 that we first saw Apple starting to ship 64-bit hardware. So no question. I mean, everybody knows that, you know, computers tend to get faster over time. They tend to pack in more memory. And with 32-bit processes, mathematically, you can't really go beyond 4 gigs. So that's not ever been a question. What's been, you know, more of a surprise to us was the fact that Apple canceled the Carbon 64 effort, which they had already been working on for some time, which they announced at WWDC 06. You know, that was the change in course.
John, I think you bring up a really good point a minute ago that Apple is not doing the same thing in terms of Cocoa with some of their applications. So it is kind of confusing as to why they're doing this. I'm asking you to look at their crystal ball, not yours. Tell me why you think this is.
Well, you know, honestly, you know, Apple's plans are their own. They certainly, you know, don't confide in us what they're up to with their internal product processes, which is, of course, fine. I guess what I would say is that I think Brent Simmons, who develops NetNewsWire, which is one of my favorite Mac applications, which is a Cocoa app, kind of hit the nail on the head. He wrote a blog post called Finder plus Cocoa equals Finder. And the, you know, what he's getting at is that simply changing the application structure that's used by a program doesn't change the essence of the program. It doesn't give it, you know, faster access to memory or more stability or kind of anything. It simply changes the way the API calls work. So to give you an example, I mean, if you're an app developer and you want to open up an error message, saying it, you know, with syntax A versus syntax B, I mean, it's the same error message either way. A customer's never going to know the difference. So I think if, you know, if I were on the Final Cut team, I'd I'd of course be looking very closely at how much work is going to be involved in porting. Now, if I were on the iTunes team, you know, I guess a question would be, well, what would be in it for customers to make iTunes a 64-bit app? Is that a way to address needs people have been voicing? And that would be, to me, a harder sell. I mean, do I really want to give my MP3 player, you know, 5 gigs or 10 gigs of RAM? Probably not. You know, probably there are lots of other things they could do that would have a bigger customer impact. So I guess what I'm saying is that simply making an app 64-bit, you know, it's nice as a checkbox feature and kind of a buzzword, but it's not something that a product team ought to do just for the sake of buzzword compliance.
Give our listeners an idea of just how difficult it is going to be for you all to switch to Cocoa and to make Photoshop 64-bit Cocoa. How long does it take? How many lines of code are we talking about?
Well, it's a great question, and I think the short, honest answer is we don't really know. Like I say, nobody, to our knowledge, has ever performed a transition on the scale of Photoshop to, you know, from Carbon to Cocoa. We need to look at probably on the order of 1 million lines of code in Photoshop, and not necessarily rewrite all of that, but at least review it and potentially update it in some ways so that all of the interface calls that we make use Cocoa as opposed to Carbon. Now, again, that doesn't actually improve them in any fashion. It simply moves them from one framework to another. So, you know, what I can tell my fellow Mac users out there is that prior to the WWDC announcement last year where it was made clear that Cocoa was the only way to build a 64-bit Mac app, you know, we were taking what we thought was the approach that would give us the biggest bang for the buck, getting rid of dependencies on old Mac technology like QuickDraw, moving to things like Quartz. And as soon as we found out that we needed to move to Cocoa, we did start peeling folks off of the CS4 effort, you know, i.e. not building features for CS4 that we otherwise had planned, and starting the Cocoa work.
So what does this mean for Photoshop and other Adobe apps on the Mac and the Windows platform?
Well, I guess what I would say, you know, kind of to echo my earlier point about, you know, apps like Final Cut versus iTunes, if I were on any other product team, I would ask a bunch of questions about how much would the ability to address a really large amount of memory help my customers? You know, if I'm on the Fireworks team, let's say, where people are using web graphics and really that's it, I would probably have a hard time convincing myself that becoming a 64-bit app would be a big win. Now, I don't want to speak for that team. I haven't talked to them about it. But it's just not a customer scenario that app is really designed to address. So I think that what you'll end up seeing is that each team will weigh the pros and cons on its own and figure out, okay, you know, is this a high priority thing or would customers rather we spent our cycles elsewhere?
John, do you want to even get into a timeline here of how long or when people can expect to see Photoshop in this new 64-bit Cocoa?
Well, you know, again, this is something where we normally try to play our cards kind of close to the vest, but what we have said is that we're presently targeting the subsequent release after Photoshop CS4, so i.e. Probably called CS5, and that's when you would see a Mac 64-bit version of the app. Now, what I'll say is that, you know, the Photoshop team has sort of a long history of really trying to do everything we can to give customers early access to updated code. So, you know, when the PowerPC first came out, I think it was like 1994, the Photoshop team did a free update. When the G5 came out, we did another free update. And when the Intel transition happened, it was more massive than we could address through, you know, just a free plugin update. But we did do a Photoshop public beta. And that gave Mac users access to native performance about 6 months faster than we otherwise could have done. So, you know, it's really a little bit speculative, and I don't want to make any promises, certainly, until we know more about the size of the effort. But what I could promise is that, you know, we'll kick over every stone we can in terms of giving people the latest and greatest stuff as soon as we can.
John, I know that you've kind of played devil's advocate here between the difference of the performance and if it's worth having to do this 64-bit Cocoa versus Carbon, but I want to make sure people understand this. You're not questioning or giving people an impression that Adobe is not committed to the platform.
Oh, absolutely not. No, absolutely. I mean, you know, what's funny, somebody, when I blog this news, a Mac user wrote in and he said, well, geez, I don't see anything about CS4 that would make me want to upgrade on my Mac. And I wrote back, I was like, well, yeah, because literally the only thing we've told you about it is the one feature that won't be there on the Mac side. I mean, it's going to be, you know, as with every release of Photoshop, we'll try to hit it out of the park and, you know, take better advantage of the graphics card, you know, do all kinds of killer features. So it really has absolutely nothing to do with platform commitment. It just has to do with, you know, the timing of Apple's roadmap for their OS changing and us taking that in stride and trying to deal with the outcome.
John Knack is Senior Product Manager for Photoshop. He spoke to us from San Jose, California. If you'd like to read a more in-depth explanation of Knack's comments on the Photoshop delay, you can get to his recent blog posting right now through our enhanced podcast link. For the record, Apple's public relations department did not return repeated emails and phone calls asking for a response to Mr. Knack's comments. So what do you think? Are Adobe's criticisms of switching to Cocoa fair, or is Apple doing the right thing for the platform and its users? We'd like your opinion. Email us at macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. We'll read some of your comments on our next episode. Again, our email address is macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Coming up, the craze in shareware bundles. What are they all about, and who do they really benefit, the shareware developer or you? Plus, Trevor Middleton with questions and answers. We talk about shareware a lot on Mac Format this week. We feel it's an important part of the Macintosh experience. There are thousands of great shareware applications and utilities out there from some pretty talented developers that offer great solutions at a reasonable price. In the last few years, we've seen a new trend in marketing shareware called the bundle, a set of, say, 10 shareware products in one discounted package that is offered for a limited time. It all started with Mac Heist back in late 2006, and it was an overnight success. Another bundle is from Mac Update, and like Mac Heist, offers a unique marketing ploy. As more people buy the bundle, certain applications are unlocked, increasing its value. So what are these bundles all about? Are they good for the developer and the shareware community? And are they a good value for you? I recently spoke to Nate Huell of the Mac Update promo, and I began by asking him to explain the current bundle offering.
Basically, we're offering 10 applications: Art Text, Hazel, Menu Calendar Clock, Leap, Storymill, Typeinator, DVD Remaster Pro, Sound Studio, Banner Zest, Parallels, for one relatively low price. It's 87% off. Yeah, I mean, that's the model.
And explain how this model exactly works. People buy the bundle, and then depending upon how many other people buy into the bundle, then certain other programs are unlocked. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, actually, when a user purchases the bundle, they get 7 applications up front. The rest of the applications are unlocked according to sales volume. After the first 5,000 sales, for example, Sound Studio is unlocked, and so on and so forth.
And at this point, Sound Studio, it might be unlocked when it reaches 5,000 bundles sold. And then what are the other two apps that could be unlocked?
The other two applications are Banner Zest from Aquafadas and Parallels.
Okay, and explain those two applications. Everybody knows Parallels mostly, but what the other application, tell us more about it.
Banner Zest is actually, it's a really cool app. I was playing around with it the other day. It's for creating web banners, obviously. And it's just a real simple way to create animated flash banners.
Where did you come up with the idea for Mac bundles? Was it off the inspiration of Mac Heist, which is another similar type of bundle?
I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that they definitely played a part in our inspiration for the MU promo bundles. I think that they did a very, very good job of marketing their initial bundle and the bundles they've run after that. So yeah, they were definitely one of the sources for the inspiration of us creating the MU promo bundles.
Take us through the process of recruiting developers for a bundle like this. I mean, how do you convince them to sell their products for drastically less than the retail price?
I think one of the key selling features for us when we're negotiating with the developers is to try and get them to realize that these bundles aren't just a one-time benefit to the developer. It's not just the cash up front that's necessarily important. It's a great way to get exposure that a lot of developers, I don't want to say they can't afford it, but let's face it, advertising is very expensive. And this is a great way to get exposure and create a solid foundation. I mean, you can gain, I think the last bundle we ran was close to 13,000 users. The one before that was 15,000 customers. So you can really increase your foundation and create a solid user base for the future. So I think that the money is a side benefit. I think the most important benefits of the promo are the increasing your user base and getting your name out there, getting a lot of exposure.
Yeah, I would think it really allows them to get some exposure that they otherwise wouldn't, get some users that they otherwise wouldn't, and then work off of it for the future.
Correct. I mean, you look at Mac Update alone, and Mac Update gets around 250,000 views daily. The developers that are participating in the bundle currently have their applications on the front page of Mac Update. I mean, that's some pretty significant exposure, not to mention the our affiliates, Mac Minute, and et cetera.
Now, obviously, some developers are not so keen on the idea. Why do you think that is?
I've talked to a lot of developers that feel the bundle may cannibalize sales. It's warranted. They have that feeling, but we haven't seen that that's the case. The research that we've done, staying in touch with developers after they've run the bundle or run just the daily promo even, typically sales numbers actually increase after a promo, a daily promo, or a bundle. So it's not the case that it cannibalizes sales, but I understand why they think that. So.
Do you envision running up against a shortage of willing developers and other applications down the road in the future?
That thought does cross my mind, but the more I look for applications to run in the daily promo or the bundle, the easier it gets. I don't know if it's just because MU Promo itself has gained a little bit of popularity and more developers are seeking us out, or if the Mac software industry is just, you know, growing leaps and bounds. I don't know what it is. I don't know what to tell you.
Now, some developers who have participated in past bundles, Mac Update or Mac Heist or whatever, have said that their upgrade sell-through rate is very low. I mean, only about 1% who buy an app in a bundle actually later on do a paid-for upgrade. Why do you think that is, and what does it tell you about Mac consumers?
That's a good question, and I think there are a lot of variables that would go into answering a question like that. I think it's dependent on a lot of things. This is kind of a relatively new method of selling software. I mean, I think that we've only been doing this for, well, MU Promo, we've only been doing this for 2 years in August. A lot of the developers that have been in our bundles haven't released paid upgrade paths yet. So I don't know why that is. I mean, I think there's just a lot of things that would determine that. For example, Typeinator that's in the current bundle, if you buy the bundle, you're getting a license for Typeinator for the next 2 years. So I don't know.
The interest in these bundles is probably much greater than the actual number of Macs sold. I mean, you know, a small amount, 25,000 bundles versus 25 million plus Mac users out there. I would think that what you want to do is you don't want to saturate the market by selling too much that would end up hurting the developer or the shareware developer itself, right?
Yeah, that's correct. But that being said, I think it would be really, really hard to saturate the market. That's an interesting topic in itself. I mean, with the percent share of the personal computing market, as far as Apple's concerned, it's growing for Apple. It's coming from somewhere. People are not using as many Dells or Hewlett Packards or whatever. So I think that if that percent share in the market keeps growing for Apple, I think the Apple software industry is going to have to do the same thing.
Shareware for the Mac has always been out there, but it doesn't seem to be something that really sells very well or has had a difficult time getting the exposure that it needs. Do you think that Mac Heist and the Mac Update bundle have given that exposure to shareware developers in a way they'd never been able to get before?
I do. I really do. And I think the daily promo that Mac Update offers, the MU promo, it does that as well. I think the developers get a whole host of benefits. Like I said earlier, you're getting exposure in the form of advertising. You're building your user base and you're getting your name out there. So I think it's beneficial to shareware developers in that they don't have to spend, you know, a couple thousand dollars to get an ad on a website that gets a decent amount of traffic. So I think it's good for shareware developers.
Nate Huell of the Mac Update promo. We spoke to him from Denver, Colorado. If you'd like more details on the Mac Update promo, you can click right now on our enhanced podcast link. And we'd love to hear your thoughts on these shareware bundles. Are they a good deal? And have you ever bought one? We'd like to hear your opinion. Email us at macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. We'll read some of your comments on our next episode. Again, our email address is macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. We answer your questions here on Mac Format this week on every episode with Trevor Middleton, who rejoins us again. Hi, Trevor.
Hey there, Brad. How's it going?
Very good. You can email Trevor with your questions, whether they be about your Mac or your iPod or your iPhone, to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. Please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. Let's get right into the questions. Question one from Darren Wells in Newberry, who writes us, "My issue is that I can't share my master iTunes library on my new 20-inch iMac to my older G4 machine. I've reinstalled macOS 10.4 on the G4 and recently upgraded the 20-inch to Leopard, but still, no joy. Leopard sees the G4 and its Finder shared list, but iTunes on the G4 doesn't see the shared library. The Finder on the G4 doesn't see the 20-inch iMac either, so the problem seems to be with the G4. The G4 is talking to the network wirelessly via a D-Link router. Do you think that that's the problem, or is there something lurking in system preferences that I've missed that's stopping the G4 talking to the network?" Trevor.
Okay, well, that's quite a complex problem. There are a lot of factors to take into account here, and the best approach to this type of problem always is to simplify. First of all, though, check the obvious. Make sure that file sharing is enabled on each Mac. That's in the sharing preferences. Then try using a simple Ethernet crossover cable to connect the two Macs together so that you can eliminate the network settings as one potential cause. If you don't know how to do that, Darren, get in touch with us here and I'll go through that with you by email. Once you've simplified, taken the network back to its simplest form, you can start to add in the other parts of the equation. If reinstating the wireless network causes the problem to recur, try borrowing a new wireless router and see if that resolves the problem, and then gradually build up the complexity of your system again until you've eliminated the cause. Brad.
Question two is from Tim O'Shea from St. Albans, and he writes us with a little bit of a complex question. "I have a question regarding Leopard smart folders. I was browsing my Mac's drive in Finder and decided to look at all the images. Imagine my horror when explicit images appeared in preview in the Finder window. Upon further investigation, I found these images were embedded in emails in the spam folder of my Gmail account. As I have this set up in Mail as an IMAP server, the messages in the spam folder were being synchronized onto a cache area on my Mac, and because these were images, they were picked up by all the images' smart folder. The Gmail folder is named Spam and is different to the Junk folder. Looking at the smart folder options, you can differentiate by type junk, but not spam. Is there any way to edit the search parameters to not include IMAP folders other than those explicitly specified?" Kind of complex, but Trevor, take a stab at it.
Tim, this boils down to a couple of options, I think. First of all, it is possible to set the criteria for a smart mailbox to exclude certain folders. So yes, that's one option. Another one, and possibly one you could do as well, is to go into the system preferences and then Spotlight, and then into the privacy section and exclude both the Gmail spam folder and that cache folder from Spotlight searches, and then those images won't appear in the all images saved search. Brad.
Okay, and finally, question three is from Neil Cunningham in Hillsborough, Northern Ireland. "I have a 13-inch MacBook that is less than 1 year old. I have recently noticed two cracks on the underside of the case at the rear. There's a similar problem around the trackpad. How do I go about getting the cracks repaired? I purchased the MacBook over the phone from Apple." Trevor.
Neil, as this product's under warranty, in the first instance, I'd take it to your nearest authorized service provider. There is one near you, and I've already sent you their address. Now, they will examine the MacBook, and if necessary, they can make a report to Apple, who, as you say, you bought the MacBook from. Now, under the terms of the UK's Sale of Goods Act, Apple are entitled in the first instance to offer you a repair, and you are more or less obliged to accept in order to give them a fair chance to rectify the situation. If all is well, Neil, the repair should resolve the matter. However, the UK Sale of Goods Act does also state that items should be of satisfactory quality. That's the precise phrase, of satisfactory quality. And that applies for 6 years from the date of purchase. So you do have some comeback if the case begins to crack again. Also, once your authorized service provider has examined the machine, Apple's telephone technical support supervisors do have a certain amount of discretion over warranty matters. So once your MacBook's been examined, try calling them and asking to speak to a supervisor. making sure that you've already told them that the MacBook's been examined and they might be willing to negotiate with you on a resolution to this problem. Let us know how you get on anyway, Neil, and back to you, Brad.
All right, Trevor, thanks so much for your help again this episode. We'll see you again.
No problem. See you next time.
You can email Trevor with your questions to machelpme@futurenet.co.uk. Please tell us where you're from and how to pronounce your name. And that's it for another edition of Mac Format This Week. My thanks to John Knack, Nate Huell, and Trevor Middleton. Our associate producer is Misha Sakalaropoulou. You can always send your comments and suggestions to us at macformatthisweek@futurenet.co.uk. Join us again for our next edition on Monday, the 12th of May. Until then, I'm Brad Gibson. Thanks for joining us.